So we've been going through the transmission of the Bible, and that entailed the composition and the consolidation and all the stuff downstream. Did anyone have any lingering questions about any of that stuff that we left 2 weeks ago that you wanted to bring up before we launch into the next section here? Okay. It was really an interesting phase for us as a class because it brings up so many questions about the composition of the Bible, and so we had a lot of lively discussions, and so it was a great twisting of the mind, I think. I was talking to someone today who said, "I can't believe you get away with the things you get away with teaching in this situation," because a lot of this is so mind-bending for Christians who have been taught a certain way about what the inspiration of the Bible is all about. So thanks for being flexible mentally as we go through this. What I want to jump into this evening is actually the development of writing. And you may be wondering how this pertains to the Bible, but it actually does in very fundamental ways. The Bible comes at a time in our history when writing was still in its infancy. And in fact, the events of the Bible that are described in the Bible come from a time, some of it possibly, if not pre-writing entirely, at least pre-alphabet. And the alphabet is a real watershed in the development of writing. And as we come through the process of how writing came to be, you'll see that the alphabet was the revolutionary concept that changed everything. So certainly the oral tradition that we talked about, remember the path toward the written composition of the Bible started with oral tradition, started with record keeping. There are some scholars that even disbelieve that Moses could have written down the law or written down any of the records that are either ascribed to him or that God commands him to do in the Bible, because there was no writing at that time. Writing hadn't been invented yet. So scholars differ on the dates of all of these various advances in the development of writing. And I'm sorry? Yes. Well, that's the scriptural tradition. That's what Scripture says. And Moses is commanded to write down the law and write down different records of the of various travels of the Jews in Canaan and so in the wilderness and so on and so forth. And some scholars say, well, you know, that couldn't be because writing hadn't been invented yet. But you may gotta remember, all these dates are moving all over the place. You know, the traditional dates of the Exodus and the traditional dates of the patriarchs are in flux, as well as these dates of writing and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of movement around. The point is that the Bible was coming into being at the same time that writing was coming into being. And so the two were kind of growing up together. And we see the marks, the kind of archaeological evidence of this moving wavefront of the development of writing in the various ancient manuscripts that we have. And so they kind of move hand in glove. And so as we are talking about the way that the Bible was composed, writing has a part to play in that. So what I want you to do to kind of begin is to imagine that you are plunked down in some alien land and you're trying to communicate with other human beings. And for those of you who have traveled and maybe you're trying to get street directions or make yourself understood in a foreign country when you didn't understand the language and they didn't understand yours, what is the typical way that you do it? Pictures? Hand gestures? What's that? Pointing at things? Absolutely. I love that. So these are the typical ways that you try to make yourself understood. They're kind of universal gestures, you know. There's sleep, and there's baby, and kind of love, and there are things that you can do to try to get certain concepts or ideas across. You point at things, you know. You maybe make, you know, gestures or diagrams in the air, and then eventually you start making pictures and writing pictures. The way that we would try to communicate to someone else is exactly what was happening 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago as people were moving into this concept of writing. Now, before that, before there was any concept of writing, there was some sort of rudimentary communication, and maybe that consisted of some sort of gestures or hand movements or some kind of maybe even sign language. Perhaps if some Neanderthal or cave dweller, every time they were excited about seeing something, they went, ooh, ooh. So eventually, ooh became the sound for look or something like that. But these sounds that were uttered along with it eventually got associated with certain ideas within certain groups of people. And so what we have then is in these earliest attempts to communicate, the fastest and easiest way was to draw a picture. And a picture could be universal because it points to a universal experience. When the Beijing Olympics were taking place, they came up with a series of pictograms that let people from any country know what event was going where. And they had all these stylized drawings of the different events, and so you could tell without having to have any language, you know, where you were supposed to go and what venue you were seeking and so on and so forth. So those pictograms and drawings were the first attempts at communication. So when you go back to the drawings on the cave walls at Lacaux in France and different places, and you see the scenes of hunting or whatever it happens to be, these were oral tradition and oral stories now being depicted in a drawn form that would survive and would last from generation to generation. You come back from a great hunt, and you tell the story around the campfire, and then someone draws the picture on the wall, and it's there for posterity now. Certain symbols and pictures and drawings became used over and over again, depending on what objects were most important to that group of people. So objects like sun, objects like the ox, objects like any prey or quarry, those things were being used. And as they were being used over and over again to get certain concepts across, then they became more and more stylized as time went on and simplified and easier to understand. The trouble with pictures is that they're obviously open to interpretation. Now, if you see a picture of an ox, what is it that you're really trying to convey? And so there was a need as mankind went forward to become more and more precise about the way that they communicated with each other. So early on, what do you think was the most important thing that people would want to actually commit to some sort of writing? What's that? Food and water? Well, actually, it was in business. They had to keep track of who bought and sold how much and for what and who owed what to whom. And so, once again, it's business driving the process of writing, you know. And so that need, when people started actually living in urban settings, when agriculture allowed people to have the opportunity to be able to buy and sell and have some sort of commerce, the first thing that these writing systems were applied to was the record keeping of that commerce. And so these earliest business transactions were being written in these sort of pictograms, and pictograms are just pictures that are now used to represent something. Either represent an exact object. If it's a picture of a sun, it's the sun. If it's a picture of an ear of corn, it's an ear of corn, and how many ears of corn, and so on and so forth. They could also then be later used to represent certain sounds, but they were initially there to represent the object itself. And so the earliest thing were these business transactions that were being taking place in these urban settings. The trouble with a pictogram is, how do you draw a picture of an abstract concept? How do you draw a picture of love or fear or envy? You know, these abstract concepts are difficult. Now, if you're trying to get across a concept like strength, well, maybe you use the ox, because that was the strongest domestic animal that they had in the Middle East. And so, but it's difficult, and you can see the problem of trying to have pictures. The other thing is, if you have a system based on pictures that are representing objects, or the next step would be logograms, where pictures are now representing concepts or ideas. An ideogram would be another example. Hi, come on in, Daniel. If you just think about that, you're trying to come up with a writing system based on pictures that are representing objects or ideas. Can you think of the immediate thing that's going to be the problem? How many signs are you going to need in order to represent a full language and everything that is going on within your daily life? See, the Chinese writing system is a logogram writing system. And the Chinese have over 10,000 symbols in their writing system, most of which are not used today in the modern language. But you can see that if you're using pictures, you got an immense amount of symbols that you're going to need. And so this needs to be culled down in some way to make it manageable. Even today in Japanese, there are over 2,000 symbols that in the traditional script that they need to parse through. And they've culled it down to about 600 that the school children need to learn. That's 600 symbols. How many letters do we have in our alphabet? 26. You know, that's why the alphabet was such a watershed. And here's basically what happens. The original thing is you draw a picture that represents an object, and then you refine that so the picture now represents a concept. You refine it again because in the spoken language, what are we using to really communicate? We're using sounds that we can make with lips, teeth, and our vocal folds, right? And so we're just parsing those. There's a limited amount of sounds that we can actually make, whether they're consonants or whether they're vowels or any clicks and pops or whatever the language may include. But there's only so many sounds that we can vocalize, that we can actually make, right? So if the written language is now meant to somehow write down the spoken language, now we can take those pictures and we can let them represent sounds. And so in a syllabic language, written language, what's happening is the signs or the symbols are now representing a syllable. And that's a combination of a consonant and a vowel. All right? So a syllable is now represented by a sound. Hieroglyphics were a combination of symbols representing objects, concepts, and syllables. If you refine that even further, you get to the actual alphabet. What the alphabet allows you to do is each symbol represents a single sound, either a consonant or a vowel. Now we only need a very few because there's only a few sounds that we can actually physically make. And the words come when you combine the various sounds. So a word like dog, you know, we've got a D sound, we've got a vowel sound, and we've got a closing G, another consonant. So we have three symbols that we use for those three sounds that make up that word. We don't need a separate symbol just for dog. We have reusable symbols now that can be mixed and matched and can create, you know, literally tens of thousands of words, hundreds of thousands of words. It also means that any spoken language can literally be written with any alphabet, any markup system. You know, they're interchangeable. And so what we see happening with the ancient languages is that they might have started with one script, but then they moved to a different script and a different script as they move through time. As the biblical people are moving through time and connecting with other peoples around them or being dragged into exile, they are being also connected with other writing forms, other languages. And that mixture starts to creep into the Bible as well. The movement from Hebrew to Aramaic was one of those, as they were mixed with the Assyrians and with the Babylonians who all spoke Aramaic. And then the very script that they used moved from what was called Paleo-Hebrew, an early alphabet, to a later alphabet. So what I want to do, just with that overview, let's go to this type of writing systems, and we're going to go through them in more systematic order. And we'll just kind of read through this. And I'm sorry? Oh, you didn't get them? Yeah. And I need to get to page 78 here because there's a little bits and pieces I want to read to you. But writing systems can be conveniently classified into broad types depending on the way they represent their underlying languages. Logographic, this is the one we were just talking about, logograms. A system of this kind uses a tremendous number of signs, each to represent a morpheme. A morpheme is the minimal unit in a language that carries some meaning. So a logogram, a sign in a logographic system, may represent a word or a part of a word, like a suffix to denote a plural noun. And because of this, the number of signs could grow to staggering numbers, like the Chinese, which has more than 10,000 signs, most of them unused. And here are a few examples of logographic languages. From logographic, we now move to the next step, logophonetic, somewhat like a stripped-down version of a logographic system. In essence, there are two major types of signs, ones denoting morphemes and ones denoting sounds. Most of the logophonetic systems are logosyllabic, meaning that their phonetic signs mostly denote syllables. An exception is Egyptian, whose phonetic signs denote consonants. And you see some of the earliest languages known to man, Akkadian and cuneiform and Elamite. Those are right out of the Mesopotamian basin there, and some of the earliest known systems known to man. Syllabic. In a syllabic writing system, the overwhelming number of signs are used solely for their phonetic values. These phonetic signs are syllabograms, meaning that they represent syllables rather than an individual sound. A few non-phonetic are used for numbers, punctuation, and commonly used words. And you got Cherokee in there, and Ethiopic, and a few other, Old Persian. Then there's a consonantal alphabetic. The consonantal alphabets are also known as abjads and are descendants of the Proto-Sinaitic script. In a pure consonantal alphabet, vowels are not written. However, early consonantal alphabets used certain conventions too, and whatever was left there is cut off. But certain conventions, basically what they're talking about, is to denote the vowels. Now, Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic are all part of this group. They were all consonantal alphabetic writing systems. In other words, they only use consonants to write down, at least in the ancient forms. Later, the Masoretes, between 500 and 1000 CE or AD, whatever dating system you want to use, started to add diacritical marks, dots and dashes and things in around the consonants that would denote the vowels. But basically, this is what they're talking about, a consonantal system. All right, just consonants. Then you get into a syllabic alphabetic. South Asian scripts, such as Brahmi and its descendants, fit into both syllabary and alphabet. It is syllabic because the basic sign contains a consonant and a vowel. However, every sign has the same vowel, such as the A in Brahmi. To make syllables with a different vowel, you add special markings to the basic sign, which is somewhat like an alphabet, hence the name syllabic alphabet. And then on the next page, we have one more, a C and V alphabetic. Nearly all the sounds in a language can be represented by an appropriate consonant and vowel alphabet. However, just take a look at the English spelling and you can almost feel we're getting back to logographic systems. But this is the alphabet that we have, where each sound is either a vowel or a consonant. And so you can have a very small number of signs. We've got 26, Hebrew had 22, and we can make up all of the words that we need to by just combining these sounds. And it is a written form of our spoken language. I just want to read you the little bit, and if you have your books, it's on page 79. Let's start with logograms. I just want to give you a little bit more information here. A logogram is a picture that represents a concept, and each picture may have several different meanings. For instance, a picture of a bee might signify a bee, the actual insect, or it may be the first unit in the word business. So in order to express abstract ideas, the meaning of the original sign was expanded to include other desired meanings. A picture could now stand for sun, a symbol which can be labeled as a pictogram, or it could express the ideas of day or time or bright or light and others. So you can see where the logogram can start to take on a lot of associated meanings once you have the picture of the sun. When we move to syllabic writing, in the next stage of writing, signs no longer represent a concept but a sound, usually a consonant and a vowel or vice versa. The wedge-shaped signs of Sumerian became highly stylized, laying the foundation for an alphabet as described by Scoville. The syllabic writing systems of Mesopotamia and Egypt did not develop into a system of alphabetic writing, although the Egyptians had a number of signs for single consonants, which were used primarily for the transcription of foreign names and so on and so forth. But now we get to the alphabet. In this stage, a letter equals a sound, so that words are formed by placing together certain sounds. The word alphabet comes from the first two letters of the Greek alphabet, alpha and beta, which represent the Phoenician and the Hebrew words, the first two letters of their alphabets. The alphabet, with its ability to reduce a language to between 20 and 30 signs, revolutionized communications. In 1946 in Japan, an attempt was made to reduce the number of writing symbols to 1,850. Reduce it to 1,850, of which 881 were to be taught in elementary schools. So you can see how cumbersome, you know, a logographic system is compared to an alphabetic system. These numbers sound incredible to the Western mind, since English-speaking peoples are able to represent their language in just 26 letters. It is uncertain which language was the first to have an alphabetic script, but there are several possibilities. One possibility is the Proto-Sinaitic, the Canaanite system, and several inscriptions commonly classified as graffiti discovered in 1905 were examples of this, and so on and so forth. What I want to do, though, is now show you some examples of this so that you can start to get an idea of what we're talking about here. So turn to, I think it would be the third page, where figure 6-4, there's a chart there, a graph, okay? Now, this chart shows how several common words developed from pictograms to cuneiform writing. So you see, in that first column there, the pictogram, bird, fish, ox, sun, grain, orchard, foot. The pictures are pretty easy to understand. They clearly represent what each of the names are. But as you go across time, and how do we know these? We have various examples of this in a chronological order. You know, they found these in layered pits and that sort of thing. And you can see how things changed over time. Now, there's a real interesting change from the first column to the second column. You notice what happened there? And nobody knows really why, but somewhere around the sixth to the fifth century BCE, before Jesus, all of these symbols turned 90 degrees on their side. And no one really knows why this happened, but in looking at earlier samples and samples from this period, everything just rotated. Very interesting. So we have the pictogram staying relatively the same, but going through this rotation, and then you see them getting further and further stylized. And the other thing was, how are they going to write these things down? Typically what was happening was, is that instead of using curved letters, it was much quicker to use just a wedge, what was called a stylus. And this wedge was pressed into soft clay. All right. And so now you see in the third column what is developing into cuneiform. Cuneiform comes from the Latin word for wedge, because when this stylus was placed, one edge was thicker than the other, so it had a wedge shape to it. And so they decided to use all straight forms. It was just using the stylus, just pressing it into the clay. So now from these curved shapes, we go to the straight shapes that are possible using the stylus in the wet clay. And then finally, they're stylized even further. So it's getting simpler and simpler, more and more stylized. But also, if you were to just look at the last column, would you have any idea what they originally represented? Of course not. They have gone so far that now they have their own meanings assigned to them, but they no longer directly represent what they originally were set to represent. But the thing to remember, though, is in the Semitic languages, the meaning was retained. So, for instance, Aleph, which was that ox head, that was originally what the Aleph looked like. All right. And eventually, it came to be our letter A. If you take the letter A and you turn it upside down, you still have that triangular-shaped head and the two horns. So it's still an A. And the bet, the B, was originally a layout of the Semitic tent with two halves for men and the women and a wall down the middle. So if you think about a B, it still retains that shape. So the shapes were still generally there. The meanings were retained, even though they weren't clear anymore. Turn the page again and see how this works out in our own modern day. I love this one. This is the Bell System logo and the history of the Bell System logo. So in 1889, it's real pictorial. But as you go through all the different versions of the logo out to 1969, you can see how it gets more and more simplified, more and more stylistic. You can still tell it's a bell, but it's much more stylistic. And this is what happens over time. You know, things that are very detailed, things that are very ornate, tend to simplify and get stylized and over time get more and more streamlined. And the same thing was happening in terms of these pictograms. So turn the page again. And here is a family tree of the major alphabets. One of the things that we don't realize is that almost all of our, certainly our Western alphabets, are derivatives of the first early Proto-Canaanite alphabet, or the Sinaitic alphabet. So you see that Egyptian hieroglyphics, my little notation there, possibly gave rise to the Canaanite alphabet. And that could have been because of the connection between the Semite peoples and in their stay in Egypt. But they came up with this system, and that's the system that we're talking about here, these pictograms. And then look what comes down from that family tree. We have Ugaritic, we have Phoenician, and we have Proto-Arabic coming out from this. So you've got an alphabetic system, a system of cuneiform writing that the Canaanites are using in the Middle East at this time. And all the other peoples, because it's such a good system, in their trading with them, and they're connecting with them, start to adopt that system. But as they take that system home with them, it starts to move and change. Just like we talked about the manuscripts of the Bible being consolidated in their various regions as they move geographically apart, same thing's happening with the alphabet. The alphabet is starting to move and change, but its roots are still with that main trunk there. And so out of the Phoenician alphabet now that develops out of this Proto-Canaanite alphabet, we have the first versions of Greek being developed. And if you know your Homer, at the end of the Trojan War, Aeneas, who was one of the princes of Troy, escapes from the burning ruins of Troy with his father on his back. And where does he escape to but to Italy? And he founds the city of Rome, at least in classical thinking. So we see the Etruscan, Latin, and other Italic alphabets also branching off from the earliest versions of Greek and being exported to Italy. And then we see Greek, early Greek, being and modern Greek coming down. On the other side, we've got Aramaic and Old Hebrew and also Arabic, also branching off from the same stream. Remember I told you that those three languages, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Arabic, are really more almost like dialects of each other because they share so many commonalities and they share a common alphabet. And they were also that consonantal form of writing system. So Old Hebrew then gives rise to Samaritan, Proto-Arabic to South Arabian and Ethiopian. Aramaic has all these different dialects and also was a precursor of Brahmi, which is a language that moved into India and Southeast Asia. And then we have modern Arabic branching out of Aramaic, Persian branching out of that, which we call Farsi. And then of these various dialects of Aramaic, you see the NPS, you know, Nabataean and Syriac and Jewish versions. The ones that are the most important to us would be the Jewish version and the Syriac version. And the Syriac is important because the Peshitta, which is the only full version of the Bible that we have in Aramaic, is a Syriac version. So when we talk about an Aramaic version of the Bible, what we're talking about is a Syriac version of the Bible, which is a different dialect than any of the others. So actually, when we are talking about the Aramaic version, it's not necessarily the dialect. It wouldn't be the dialect of Aramaic that Jesus spoke. He would have spoken a Galilean version of Aramaic or a Jewish version of Aramaic, which was even different than the version that was spoken in Judea. Remember how Peter, after the trial, is accused of being one of the followers of Jesus, and the girl at the fire says, you know, I can tell by the way you speak. What she's saying is that she could tell by his dialect of Aramaic that he came from Galilee, and so she knew him by his speech. So there were various dialects of Aramaic running around at the same time, and Peter would have been like the across the tracks hick version, basically, because that's what they thought of Galilee in the first place. So, but it's fascinating to see how all of these alphabets are branching off of that original tree, and so obviously, what comes from us, our alphabet comes from the Latin alphabet. And so our alphabet also traces this road all the way back. And if you turn the page again, we can see how these alphabets line up with each other. So we have a letter name, and these are the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, from Aleph to Tav. And then in the Proto-Sinaitic, you have those pictographic forms of each of those. And some of them, most of them, retain some sort of semblance to the letter meaning at the far end. What's that? Oh, look where you're going with that. God, Tony? Somebody had to say it. Yeah, Ayin looks like a football. So from those that Proto-Sinaitic or pictographic script, we get what is called Paleo-Hebrew, or the early Phoenician script. And so you can see how it becomes much more stylized. All right? Now, the Bible is written, we talked about three languages. Y'all remember which three languages? Aramaic, Greek, and Hebrew. It's also written, at least the Old Testament is written in Aramaic and Hebrew, but it's also written in two different alphabets. And the two different alphabets, one of them is this Old Hebrew or Paleo-Hebrew alphabet. The other would be the Assyrian square script, and we'll talk about that in a second. Why is it important if we can find evidence of books of the Bible being written in a different alphabet? It gives us clues to the dating, because one superseded the other. And so all of these are important, because remember, none of these books are dated. And we're trying to use all these forensic techniques to try to figure out what's the dating of a book and where does it come from and so on and so forth. All of these things are clues. If we see a book written in proto or Paleo-Hebrew as opposed to square script, that gives us an insight into the dating of it. But even books that were written in square script had throwbacks. And especially the name of the word of God, the Yahweh, the Tetragrammaton, the YHVH, Yod Heh Vav Heh, that would often be written, and we got an example of it later on in an upcoming page, of where everything is written in square script except the name of God reverts to the Paleo-Hebrew, to that earlier version. Then you see the Greek alphabet coming out of the early Phoenician or the Paleo-Hebrew, and you can see the similarities between it. Nearly all the Greek letters come from the Hebrew letters. There were some sounds that the Greeks made that didn't correspond to anything that was available to them, and so they just made up new letters. You know, what else can you do? You know, you got a sound that doesn't exist, you make up a new letter for it. But the original alphabet came from this Phoenician or Paleo-Hebrew. And then the phonetic value gives us the sounds that correspond with each one of these signs. So the phonetic values on my little scratchy notes on the side there. The phonetic values, the order is just about the same in all of these systems. They were borrowing from each other, coming through that family tree. And here's another fascinating little thing here. Y'all know that Hebrew is written from what direction? From right to left. We write from left to right, and Hebrew writes from right to left. But it wasn't always so. As these writing systems were being developed, they're experimenting with all different sorts of ways of writing and putting their language down until they finally settled on some sort of convention. But as you look at Greek, especially from the earliest forms of it that we have to later forms, look at number three there. In the earliest versions, Greek is written from right to left, just like Hebrew, modern Hebrew, is written. Then around 900 BCE, it began to be alternating. It went from right to left, you got to the end of the line, and then you wrote from left to right, you got to the end of the line, and you wrote from right to left. You think that sort of makes sense, because you're already there. You can just go down a line and continue back the other way. And the word for that was boustrophedon, which literally means as the ox plows. That's the way they had the ox plow their fields. They went down one row, they turned the corner, and they came back the other way, and they turned the corner. So there's a period in Greek where it was going both directions in an alternating fashion. And then finally, around 500 BCE, it settles on from left to right, which is what it is today, and we have inherited that system. But there are early examples of Hebrew where the writing also goes from left to right, and we're going to see one of those. Most Greek letters and names are meaningless in Greek, but have meanings in Semitic languages. And the example here would be Alpha and Beta, which literally would mean ox and house. And those letters would have that name. So there is this evolution and this borrowing and this family tree that's going on here. Yeah. Shin means teeth. Yeah, the letter shin means teeth. And so it's kind of a crude representation, but the W there sort of retains the shape of teeth, you know. Hey, yeah, it's the symbol of a person with their hands up, you know, excitement and look and see and that sort of thing. Yod hey, vav hey.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly how you would lay that out. The yod is an arm or a hand. So typically the hand would be the symbol for yod, okay. And then hey would be the person. But typically the hey sound, the H sound, was a symbol for light. You know. So light, illumination, it was that sort of idea. Remember when, it also had it carried the connotation of breath, because breath is expelled with the letter H. Interestingly, when Abram's name is changed to Abraham, when Sarai's name is changed to Sarah, it's the addition of the hay that is the major change there. And so, kind of mystically speaking, what's being added there is the breath of God or the light or the illumination of God, because at that those critical times in their life that their name is changed, it's the addition of that God breath in them. Their faith is illuminated, if you want to look at it that way. Similarly, when Saul's name is changed to Paul, the shin at the beginning of Saul, which we just said means teeth, is changed to a P. And pay means mouth. And so symbolically, Saul is changed from the biter, the one who is persecuting the people around him, to the mouthpiece of God. This is the one who speaks for God. And so you can see where these letters, you know, the meanings of these letters are carried through in the names. And the name changes that occur are significant, not only in the actual meaning of the new name itself, but even in the letters that are used to depict the change. Abram means father. Abraham means father of a multitude. So you see the change there. Isaac's name is Jacob's name, which means heel catcher or supplanter, is changed to Isaac after he wrestles with God. Remember? He has that dream where he wrestles with God. And what does Israel mean? Did I say that right? Jacob's name is not changed to Isaac. Jacob's name is changed to Israel. Isaac means the one who laughs, because they laughed when he was born, or were told that he was going to be born. But Jacob's name is changed to Israel, which means one who struggles with God, which is very appropriate for the nation of Israel, because they were constantly struggling with God. But these names all mean something, because the letters mean something. So the combination of the letters into a word or into a name all have significance, and everything has meaning. The thing to also remember is, at this time, the people did not have any separate system for writing numerals. So the 22 letters of the alphabet also did double duty as numerals. And then there are five letters of the Hebrew alphabet. It's Kuf, Mem, Nun, Pe, and Sade. They have different forms when they're written at the end of the alphabet, at the end of a word, as when they're written in the middle of a word. So that gives us five more letters to work with for a total of 27. So in the numbering system, what they did was the first 10 letters of the alphabet were just equivalent to the first 10 integers, 1 through 10. The next 10 were counting by 10. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. And then the last two, 1,000, were written in hundreds. So it went 1,000, 1,100, and then you use those last five or so, or 1,200, and then you use the last five, that'll get you up to 900. So you had a system that could go from 1 to 900, and then by combining all those letters, you could get pretty much every other number that you wanted to. But it went by individual digits to tens to hundreds. Yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No signing here. Except for a few.
I couldn't follow him back then, I'm trying to remember.
Yeah. I cannot sign. I have a few reserve signs I could make, but not here. But when you think about it, it's a fascinating interlocking system. You've got the 22 letters plus the five, what they're called sophit, the final forms. And each one of those letters has a meaning. Each one has a numerical equivalent. Each one of those numbers also has a meaning. And we've talked about that a lot in here, the meaning of numbers. So you've got two independent meaning systems that interlock into a word-based system. And each time you create a word out of the letters combine their meanings to give you the meaning of the word. And at first you have a two-letter, what's called a parent root. So Ab, Aleph and Bet, would be father in Hebrew. And that meaning comes from the idea of the ox, which is strength, you know, the strong animal, the strongest domestic animal, and Bet, house. And so literally, Ab means the strength of the house. The father was understood as the one who brought strength to the house. He was the one who defended the house. He's the one who grew the proceeds of the estate and the family and all that sort of thing. Whereas, for instance, mother, Em, also Aleph and Mem, literally meant strong water. The Mem, if you look at the Mem there, see, it's the ripples of the water. So Mem had the connotation of water. Strong water was the glue that they used as an adhesive when they tanned animal hides and boiled them. What rose to the surface was a sticky substance that they used as a glue. So the woman, the mother, was the one who bound the family together as that strong water. So their ideas of the roles of the basic relationships or of the basic elements of their lives were coded into these the oldest roots were the two-letter roots. Then you add a third letter and you get a child root, and you can add a fourth letter and you get words. And so this is a root and pattern system, all built on this interlocking system of this alphabet. But remember, since each letter also has a numerical equivalent, which also has a meaning, you've got a whole other system that superimposes on top of that one. So for instance, King David's name, my name, you know, would be Dalet Vav Dalet. We would write it as D-W-D, and it was pronounced David, all right? But each one of those letters also had a numerical equivalent. And so the Dalet is 4, the Vav is 6, and the Dalet again is 4, which adds up to 14. If you think about the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1, there are 14 generations from Abraham to David. There are 14 generations from David to the exile, and there are 14 generations from the exile to Jesus. The important thing that's being communicated here is not the number of generations that you could actually count back and know exactly how many generations or how many years there were between Abram and Jesus, but it was the repetition of this number 14 that was important. Because what was Matthew trying to establish? That Jesus came from the line of David. 14 is the numerical equivalent of David's name and was being reinforced in each one of these segments of the genealogy. And so you see the Bible using this system to code meaning into it and to, again, that whole idea of accuracy and truth that we went over in the first weeks that we met here. You know, if something is accurate to us, it has to be true. And if it's true, it has to be accurate. But to the ancient writers of Scripture, they would play with accuracy in order to be able to reinforce the truth of what they were trying to say. Jesus came in the power of David. He was in the lineage of David and was carrying the power of the throne of David. And the genealogies were sort of timed to enforce that, reinforce that notion of truth. But here's that system at work. And that's why it's important to understand the system and how it works. Go ahead, Peter.
I'm just wondering, Psalms 119, is that whole people or the
whole sorry, say again?
Psalms 119, as you have it, the shapes of the letters.
Uh-huh.
Is that the whole people or the
Well, it could be either. It could be either.
And the Talmud assigns abstract meanings to the shapes. Are those then to be followed back to the Egyptian and Sumerian?
Well, now you're getting into Jewish mysticism, and that's taking another step forward. He's talking about mystical meanings assigned to the shapes of letters and such. Yes, there are such systems, but those came later. Those weren't, as I'm aware, part of this original system. And so there, when you get into Kabbalistic mystical understanding, it really gets quite crazy.
The Egyptian or the Sumerian.
I'm sorry, again?
There were no... apart from the logo or the pictorial, there were no abstract concepts rendered in shape at all, as far as history.
No, not as far as I'm aware of, no. And the earliest examples of the Bible we have only go back to this Paleo-Hebrew. It doesn't go back to any pictographic form. Okay, we don't have any examples of that in existence. But what he was referring to, Psalm 119, are you familiar with Psalm 119? It's what's called an acrostic. And actually, Psalms 9 and 10 together, Psalm 25, 34, 37, 111, 112, and 119 are all what are called acrostics. And what acrostic does is take each letter of the alphabet in order, and it becomes the beginning letter of that line. So if you were to read those letters, of course, we're not going to get it in our NIV version. It's not going to be there because now it's translated into a new language. But if you looked at it in the original Hebrew, you would see that each line would start with a successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And Psalm 119 is the most famous one because what it does is it has 22 sections of 8 verses each. And each 8 verses 1 through 8, each line starts with the letter Aleph. And then from 9 through, what would that be, 16, each line would start with the letter Bet. And so on and so forth down through the 22 letters. And so it was a mnemonic device, a way that they could memorize the scripture. But it was also showing the totality, you know. The Aleph Tav, in which the Hebrews connoted the entirety of the alphabet because Aleph was the first letter and Tav was the last letter. So the Aleph Tav connoted a complete circle, completion, wholeness. And so to have a psalm that went through the Aleph Tav was to denote something that was complete and perfect, you know, mature, all of those ideas. And so the Aleph Tav becomes a very important symbol in and of itself. And so the acrostics were meant to show that as they were being used. It's for us, the alphabet is just a means to an end. To the Hebrews, the alphabet had its own significant meaning. And it's hard for us to kind of wrap our heads around how important that was. And it only became more important, as Peter was alluding to, by medieval times, especially in Spain, the Kabbalists were bringing Jewish mysticism to a high art form. And what they read into the meaning of names and numbers and letters, went off the charts. It approached the Bible code system that computers are now able to kind of unleash on us in terms of the text of the Bible. But they were reading in secondary meanings. What they basically felt was, since the names of the letters and the names of the numbers were sort of interchangeable, they would interchange letters of the same that added up to the same numerical equivalent and create new words and find new meanings and codes within the text. And so they were using these symbols and these systems in that type of way, which is something, of course, we wouldn't do. But mystically, they figured that was fair game because of these interlocking systems. Kind of interesting. But not for our purposes. Turn one more page. Figure 6-9 there. This is a drawing of the Isvet Sarta. And there's a word there you may not have seen before. It's an abecedary. Have you ever heard of an abecedary? It literally means an alphabet. I'm not making this stuff up. It's a real word. But it's a drawing of the abecedary, the alphabet, composed of two interlocking clay shards. And it was found in 1976 at the excavation as Isbet Sarta, a village in the vicinity of Afek. These two astraka, and there's a word that you also may not be familiar with, but an astraka is simply a shard of pottery that has been inscribed upon. So any piece of pottery that has writing on it is an astrakon. Astraka would be the plural form. But it's kind of important to understand that in these days, writing materials were not readily available. I mean, what would you write on? You just couldn't go down to the store and buy a ream of paper. There was no paper. So people used broken pottery, bits of pottery, as scrap paper, basically. They practiced their writing on it. They wrote notes on it, you know, to give to each other and all sorts of things. So pottery was a major writing material back at this time. And, of course, wet clay was used for the production of cuneiform. But here are two interlocking shards that preserve the oldest Paleo-Hebrew alphabet yet discovered. The first four lines appear to be random letters, but the fifth is clearly the alphabet, written from left to right, not from right to left. Okay, interesting. And it's dated to the 12th century B.C. This could very easily have been a student's scrap paper, practicing his letters, or her letters, you know, going across, practicing letters. And then the bottom one, though, is clearly the alphabet from Aleph to Tav. And you can see that. If you take your next page and hold it next to this one, where we've got a Paleo-Hebrew and square script alphabets, and just kind of go from the top down and then go from left to right, and you see the symbols being written out in order from Aleph to Tav. See how that works? Now, as I was saying, you can theoretically code any spoken language with any alphabet, because the letters can mean whatever you want them to mean. And what we see is from the Paleo-Hebrew to the Greek, we see that borrowing back and forth. Different languages using basically the same alphabet with certain changes. The Jewish people early on spoke their own language, Hebrew, which was an offshoot of some mother tongue, some Semitic tongue. And they began to write it using the Canaanite alphabet, this Paleo-Hebrew script that you're seeing in that first column there. But as the powers of Mesopotamia rose in that area, beginning with the Akkadians and then moving into the old Babylonians and then the Assyrians, and when the Assyrians took the northern kingdom in the 8th century and carried off a bunch of people into their lands, the lingua franca of the entire area, as these superpowers started to arise, moved to Aramaic, which was their mother tongue. Babylonians and the Assyrians and those peoples of the Mesopotamian area, their common language is Aramaic, which then became the common language of the entire region. And so even before the Babylonian exile, we have examples of the Jewish people moving more and more toward Aramaic as their common tongue. When they end up being exiled, the southern kingdom in the 6th century exiled to Babylon, that's three generations of Jews before they are allowed to return who grow up speaking Aramaic. When they come back to Israel, they're speaking Aramaic. And Nehemiah is incensed as he's rebuilding the walls that no one's speaking Hebrew anymore. And I could give you the citation. It's Nehemiah 13:24, where he is very upset that people aren't speaking Hebrew. And there's another story or passage from it's either Nehemiah or Ezra, where the people who are sitting on the wall listening to the scriptures being read in Hebrew don't understand it anymore, and they have to be translated. And then Ezra and others actually start translating the Hebrew scriptures into Aramaic. They're called Targums, so that they're available to people who didn't understand Hebrew anymore. But Hebrew didn't die out. It was still being used in the temple, and it was much more of the formal language, the sacred language. But now we've got Hebrew. But what came also, I'm sorry, we have Aramaic. What also came with the Aramaic was the Assyrian square script, a different alphabet, a different way of writing the letters. And that also became adopted in this same period. So now we see the Paleo-Hebrew script giving way to the square script, the Assyrian script. And then when you take a look at figure 611, this is a photo of a page from the Habakkuk commentary. This is from Qumran, written in square script. But look at the divine name of Yahweh, that tetragrammaton, appears in the Paleo-Hebrew script. Do you see that? Where the arrow is pointing? So everything is in square script until you get to the name of Yahweh, and it reverts to the older script. There was a thought among the Hebrews that this square script, even though we're all using it, comes from a non-Jewish source. And so at least the name of God needs to be written in the old alphabet. You know, that was more sacred to them. And it's interesting you see this mixing as we're going forward. Absolutely.
The figure in 6-9 says it's dated the full century BC. The pyramids of Giza are only 2,000 years before Christ himself. So you're talking 10,000 years older than the hieroglyphics that we know of.
Wait. Where do you get the 10,000? No. 1200. That'd be 1200 BC, not 12,000. See how that works? Yeah. Each century being 100 years, so 12th century would be actually, you know, because there's no zero, it would actually be 1100. Did I do that right? Yeah, 1100s would be the 12th century. So if you've got the pyramids, maybe 2,000 years, 2,000 BC or so, the traditional dating of the Exodus is usually 1450, although there's lots of scholarly dispute about this. So this would be dated back, you know, to a couple hundred years, 250 years after the Exodus, something like that. Interesting. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Peter, go ahead.
You've marked them on page 2, you've marked them. In that tree that the Proto-Canaanite style of writing evolved from the Egyptian hieroglyphics. And again, it's a dating. Isn't the Sumerian the oldest form of writing? And isn't the Egyptian and Sumerian quite...
Yeah, it's not that the cuneiform system evolved from hieroglyphics, because they're two very different systems. Very different systems. The different concepts behind them, very different symbols.
Because the Canaanite, not only the language, but so much of, we read about the Canaanite civilization with their, their temples and whatever, they're so close to.
Mm-hmm.
What was then revealed by God that we do. But there's much more similarity there, and perhaps a better trace for the development of Paleo-Hebrew than it would be to suggest that Proto-Canaanite systems developed directly from the Egyptians.
Yeah, and those are just my notes, and they really shouldn't be as seen as part of the actual family tree. There are, and scholars are all over maps about this. Some date Egyptian hieroglyphics slightly older than the Sumerian cuneiform, and vice versa. And the suggestion was, that note was meant to remind me to tell you that some suggest that the idea for having a pictographic form of alphabet came when Semitic peoples were connected with the Egyptians at some point. But not to suggest that their system evolved or, evolved from their system. I'm sorry?
The story of Babel, doesn't that account for it when they supposedly God started talking different languages?
That could be an example of when a single language was split as the peoples dispersed, absolutely. But those are spoken languages and not necessarily written languages. Or it could have been both. We don't really know, because there's no way to date Babel in terms of this flow that we're talking about. So we don't know exactly when that occurred.
The Epic of Gilgamesh, what would that have been written?
The Epic of Gilgamesh,
we have that.
Mm-hmm. That would have been written in one of these Semitic Mesopotamian languages. Yeah, it would have been cuneiform, a cuneiform system, right? A cuneiform system, absolutely. Any other questions? I guess a couple other examples. Ah, yes. Turn the page again. And here's a picture of the Rosetta Stone. Y'all got to remember the Rosetta Stone, right?
Ah, that's why they call that stuff on TV the Rosetta Stone.
The Rosetta Stone was
it's language.
Yeah.
I was wondering why they called it Rosetta Stone. Now we know.
Now you know. You know why the Rosetta Stone was important? Because nobody could translate Egyptian hieroglyphics. By the time this was in 1799, this is Napoleon's armies marching through northern Africa, and the meaning of hieroglyphics had been lost, because the ancient system of hieroglyphics was replaced by another language, another writing system, and then eventually by a system called Demotic, which was a syllabic form of writing as well, but didn't use a hieroglyphic system. And then that gave way to Coptic and then modern Arabic once the spread of Islam moved into Egypt. And so as this language moved to more and more simplified and stylized forms and into an alphabetical form, the whole meaning of the hieroglyphics was lost. And so scholars had no way of recreating all of these vast hieroglyphic stories that were written on and carved into the walls of all these temples and these archaeological finds. They couldn't decipher it. So in 1799, as Napoleon's army is traipsing through the sand, they come across this stone tablet discovered in Rosetta, Egypt. And what did it contain but the proclamation in three different languages, the same proclamation in hieroglyphics, in Demotic, and lo and behold, in Greek. So they were able then to have it's like getting the key to the code. You know, that's why the Rosetta Stone has become synonymous in our language with the key to some sort of code. Because once they had it together, and it sounds like it might have been simple, but it wasn't simple at all. Because hieroglyphics is such a complicated system of both symbols that denote either concepts or objects, but also syllables all at the same time, that it was very, very difficult. And it was a Frenchman, I can't remember his name right now, who finally cracked the code fully. But without this stone, without the same proclamation in the three languages, it never would have been possible at all. And so this was what allowed scholars to finally be able to translate the hieroglyphics and get back into the minds of those Egyptians who used that pictographic system to write their language. And this table 6.3 is sort of off the topic here. It's a comparison of two legal codes, the Code of Hammurabi and the Biblical Laws, so we're not going to go into that. But if you move and turn the page again, here is figure 6.22. It is a picture of the Isaiah scroll, which is the oldest version of the book of Isaiah that we have. And I think we mentioned here before that at the time it was found in 1945, thereabouts, that it was 1,100 years older than the oldest copy of Isaiah that we had anywhere in existence. So you can imagine how important this find was. It's just staggeringly important that we can have a copy 1,000 years older to compare to. And so this copy, of course, is in Hebrew, and there's a picture of it there. And then they've got a reconstructed ivory writing tablet in figure 6.23, which really pertains more toward the writing materials, which will be the next section that we'll jump into next week. But if you turn the page one more time, remember I told you about the Peshitta? The Peshitta is the Bible written in Aramaic. Actually, our oldest dated manuscript. There are some manuscripts that they put the date on it. And the oldest dated manuscript we have, it dates to 464 AD CE, is a version of the Peshitta. And the Peshitta is the Bible written in the Syriac dialect of Aramaic. And this is a page from it. This is actually Exodus 13, 14 through 16. And it's written in what's called the Estrangula script. And Estrangula comes from, I think it's Strangulos in Greek, which means rounded. So they actually are now using rounded letters. So whereas a square script was basically using, you know, straight lines to write, this uses rounded letters. This was the oldest script that was used to denote Aramaic, and this one is in that script. And what's that? Right to left. No, just letters weren't really parsed the way we parse them, but there is some sort of parsing here, and I couldn't even tell you what those spaces mean, but they are parsed in some way. Whether that actually was done on purpose or who knows at this point, a scholar could probably tell us as they were reading through this. When we start looking at the actual languages themselves as opposed to simply the alphabets, all these little dots and dashes above and below the letters become very, very important because they completely change the meaning of the word. And they're so easy to miss, especially by non-native speakers. And so we're going to be looking at verses in the Bible which could easily be mistranslations because of a mistranslation. In this Estrangula script, as we're translating from Aramaic, and so it's really interesting to see some of these possible mistranslations. So we'll look at a few of those, and we don't know for sure. But I'll tell you one thing: that some of them, which don't make a whole heck of a lot of sense in the version that we have, when you put them back into Aramaic and translate them again, they make a lot more sense. And so we'll do some. One of them, just to let you know, for instance, Gamla can mean either rope or rope or camel, because ropes were generally made out of camel hair back in the day. And so Jesus talking about the camel going through the eye of the needle could be translated as a rope going through the eye of the needle. So there are some of those and some other ones that even change the meaning quite a lot more. So we'll take a look at some of those as well. One thing to understand is that Jesus also would have been familiar with the square script in the first century because he makes some reference to remember the jot and tittle? When he says that, heaven and earth will pass away before every last jot and tittle is fulfilled in the law. Well, the jot is actually an English version of the word iota in Greek, which is the letter yod in Hebrew. Yod is the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It basically looks like a backward apostrophe, is how it's kind of. So it's just a little mark. And the tittle was actually what we would think of as a serif, you know, a serif on the ends of the letters. Certain Hebrew letters are only distinguishable by that little mark, that little flourish at the end of a line. And so those only exist in the square script. In the Paleo-Hebrew script, they're completely different letter forms. And so they make that saying of Jesus makes no sense in Paleo-Hebrew, but makes perfect sense in the square script. So all of these things, which may seem like just trivia, are part of the basis that scholars are using to help date things, to put things into perspective, to understand what forms were available at what times. And this is why, for instance, the Dead Sea Scrolls were so important, because they gave scholars a lot more insight, because they had vastly earlier forms of the same books that had gone through lots of mutations over time. And the Hebrew had changed dramatically in 1,000 years because of the influence of the Masoretes. Now they had vowel pointing systems and all these different kinds of stuff. So to have an earlier form of these books gave tons of insight into how the language was written, the interconnection between the people and the books, and so on and so forth. So the story of writing and the story of the Bible are also hand in glove and interlinked. Just as we said, the story of history and the story of the Bible were also interlinked. All these three systems moving through time kind of in lockstep as they go forward. And looking back are giving us clues to how to figure out how all this whole thing came about and went together. Knowing these various dating systems helps scholars to see the seams that we talked about in the original languages so they can start to make some valid and informed arguments about that Holy Grail we talked about, getting to the original text. What did the original text say? All of this is by way of getting us closer and closer to understanding what that is. So,
I have a question about how is proto used and paleo used?
Paleo just means old, and proto would be an early form of, basically. So Paleo Hebrew is old Hebrew, or Proto Sinaitic would be the form that it's kind of like, think of a beta form of your software. It would be like that. It was a beta form, you know. Think of it that way. What's that? Prototype. Okay. Yeah. Same thing. Exactly. Yeah. Any other questions? Wow. This is the most I've talked at your expense, I think, yet in a given session. Yeah. But I don't know about you, but I just love this stuff, and I know I keep saying I'm an egghead, but thank you. I have one other geek in the midst. But to me, it's fascinating because it brings things back into just human terms. You know, it was like what we started with. How would you communicate if you were dropped into a foreign country where you had no way to communicate? And you use every tool available. That's what these people were doing, using every tool available. And then you see these logical leaps and evolutionary ideas as they move forward, and you see how all of those played out in this art of communication and how all of that is being used. You know, it's kind of like the Bible was being written in the state of the art of the time as that was evolving. But to think that the Bible was being composed and coming into being at the same time the writing systems were coming into being, I don't know. To me, that's just fascinating. Now, take that another step, and how does that apply to this whole idea of inspiration of the Bible that we talked about, you know, ad nauseum in here? Because God is somehow inspiring the production of this book. He's inspiring the writers. Is he creating the finished copy of verbatim? You know, we talked about the breadth of Christian thought on this, you know, but now you bring in this new element. You know, these writers are using what they had at their disposal at that time, and that was changing over time, you know. And then we see later writers or copyists of the Bible throwing back old versions of the alphabet into their manuscripts and so on and so forth, which then presents, you know, more challenges to eventual translators and copyists. And, you know, and as old languages are going out of vogue and out of usage, you know, and you lose the meaning. Remember, the Jews literally lost the pronunciation of the name of God because they stopped using it. You know, that tetragrammaton, that YHVH, Yod He Vav He, eventually, and now, we don't even know how it was originally pronounced. There's a whole bunch of different ideas about how maybe it was pronounced, but because it stayed out of usage for so long, no one is really sure anymore. We lost the meaning of hieroglyphics. Even the Egyptians didn't know what the hieroglyphics meant anymore because they stopped using them. This is why it's important when we find copies of the Bible, like the Alexandrian text, in a version of a language that stopped being used in a particular locale, a geographic locale. That's important because the language continues to evolve over time. A living language isn't static. It's always changing. It's always moving. You know, what does 23 Skidoo mean to us anymore? Well, it meant something in the 40s. Don't mean anything to us now, you know. So the language is continuing to evolve and idiomatic expressions change. But if we find a version in Greek in Egypt where Greek was not spoken for 1,000 years, we find, but essentially is a time capsule. You know, that is frozen in time. Whereas Greek, which was continually spoken in Turkey, in the Byzantine Empire for another 1,000 years, we see the copies that we have are showing the marks of going through that living language process. And so that's why scholars believe that the Alexandrian text preserves an earlier form of the text, which then may be closer to the original. Well, it depends on who you talk to. But this whole system of language is what's driving this whole thing as scholars are trying to figure out what's going on and where that original text would lie. Okay, Aaron.
Is this the whole Hebrew alphabet here, or is this just the same?
That should be the whole enchilada minus, let me see if the Sofit are there. No, the Sofit are not there. But the Sofit are just, there's five letters that I mentioned. What was it? Kuf, Mem, Nun, Sade, and Pe. Those five just had, they're just written in different forms, and they're not shown here. But there should be 22, right? Okay. So that's all of the 22 letters, but there's those five final forms that are also added to the alphabet as well. But it's the same letter, just with a different version. Yeah, so that's the whole thing. So, but for numerical purposes, they needed those extra five because that gets you up to 900, which allows you then to basically denote any number after that. Yeah, you can do that.
When you started studying Hebrew, where did you start?
Well, let me first come clean with you and say that I don't read and write Hebrew. So I don't speak the language. I don't read and write. What I've done is word studies and know just a little bit of grammar enough to be able to. What my thrust has been is to understand what the words would have meant to the first hearers. And so I haven't had the opportunity to actually learn Hebrew. I've gone through Hebrew grammars and tried to absorb as much as I could on my own, but I've never had the time to really dig in and learn the language. But what I have used is lexicons, and dictionaries, and all of these word tools, and then, of course, interlinear, which are really hard to find in Aramaic. There's not many Aramaic tools, which is a bummer. Tons of stuff in Greek, but very little, and Hebrew, but very little in Aramaic. To try to get to those word meanings. So basically, I just dug into those type of tools: Aramaic concordances, interlinears, grammars, and that sort of thing, so that I could understand as much as I could. And then reading books from scholars who do know the language and have done the word studies themselves is what's given me as much grounding as I have. And if you're interested in some of those books, I can give you a bibliography on that as well. Unfortunately, the main one that I use was really hard to find. It took me a long time to find a copy of it. They're really getting hard to find. I'm hoping that will change. Scholarship is starting to find more legitimacy in the Aramaic again, finally. And so more tools are starting to come online, but it's really slow. In the West, the bias against Aramaic is huge. And I don't know if we've talked about this fully in here, but Western scholars see Greek as primary, and most likely most of the books of the New Testament were written in Greek and not Aramaic initially, with the exception of maybe Matthew and a couple others. But we have this Peshitta, which literally means simple or straight or true, the word Peshitta. And so the Eastern Church saw that as the straight and the true and the primary version of the New Testament was this Peshitta. But that's the Eastern scholars. The Western scholars have Greek as primary. To my thinking, though, whether the books that survive of the New Testament were written initially in Greek or Aramaic is less important than where it was spoken initially. And most scholars agree almost universally that Jesus spoke Aramaic or Hebrew. Most say Hebrew. There's a growing number that say, most say Aramaic, there's a growing number that say Hebrew, and then there's a few radical guys on the fringe that said, no, he would have spoken Greek, but that's highly unlikely. So if the first thought forms and the way it was communicated orally as Jesus was speaking and teaching was Aramaic, then the Greek, even if it was initially written in Greek, is still a translation. And in fact, there are many what are that are transliterated Hebrew words, and I'll, for the sake of the recording, I'll just read them in case anybody wants to look them up later. Let's see if I can find them now. It was mostly Mark. Mark has most of the Hebrew transliterations. Okay. For instance, Mark 5:41, Jesus says "Talith hakum," you know, and it isn't translated. I mean, it's just written. The Aramaic is translated in, within the Greek, and it means "little girl, arise," where he's bringing the little girl back to life. In Mark 7:34, he says "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." This is where he's healing the deaf man, and he says "be opened." The famous one from Mark 15:14, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which means my God, why have you forsaken me?" That he's saying from the cross. Other words like "Abba," which means "father" or "daddy," would be Aramaic. "Maranatha," from 1 Corinthians 16:22, means "come, O Lord," and it also means a record label, I think, doesn't it? But that also is Aramaic. "Golgotha" itself, which means "skull," from Mark 15:22, is also an Aramaic word. So we see these Aramaisms that are left untranslated in the Gospels. So whether Greek was primary in terms of the written version, it was still spoken first in Aramaic, and had to be, those thought forms had to be translated over. So my way of thinking about this is that here we have the Peshitta. The Western scholars tell us that the Peshitta is a translation of the Greek. Okay, I'm gonna just grant that for argument's sake. The Syriac Aramaic version we have was actually translated from the Greek. But think about this. Ancient Semitic languages like Aramaic and Hebrew had very small vocabularies. Remember we've said that? So they had small vocabularies, few words, but each word had a lot of different possible meanings and sometimes simultaneous meanings. Whereas a Western language like Greek, or especially English, has lots of words. So it's very broad and very shallow, and each word is much more specific. If I'm translating from Greek, which has a lot of words, back into Aramaic, which has very few words, what are the chances of me hitting the actual word that Jesus spoke and not missing it and using another? You see, that the room for error is a lot smaller because there are fewer words that mean the thing that I'm searching for. So even if I'm translating from Greek into Aramaic, the chances that I'm getting the right word that Jesus uttered is still pretty good. And especially for a native speaker who is doing the translation, possibly as early as the first or second century, it's a kind of a chicken and egg thing. So from my way of thinking, and from at least Eastern scholars' way of thinking, the Peshitta is a very good rendition of what the original thought forms would have been as they were coming out of Jesus' mouth. And so I find that that it's valid. It's a valid use, even if it is a translation. Then, when you take into account, well, now that we have the text in Aramaic, and we take this vast meaning system and put that into place, now we have this worldview shift that starts to take place. And this is what really changed everything for me. To understand Jesus' word not from a Western point of view, but from the original Eastern point of view, and to see that language come alive and all of those meanings be reinserted. It's almost like taking a dehydrated meal for the astronauts and putting the water back into it, and it just expands to what it was originally. That's kind of the experience that I had as this was brought back into the original language. And so my understanding of Jesus' teaching from this point of view, and from many others, it's not original with me, of course, is changing everything about the way that we look at Jesus' teaching and changing the direction that we take it. But I just wanted to bring that out to you because I want you to know, first of all, that all scholars don't agree about which came first, the Aramaic Hebrew or the Greek. And they don't necessarily see the legitimacy of using the Aramaic because they see the Greek as primary, which is why there are so few Aramaic tools to be had. And the main concordance and lexicon that I use, I had to really search high and low through a lot of dusty online stores before I could finally find a copy. And it took a while. So that's one of my prized things on the bookshelf. If the house burns down, it's going to be tough if I lose that book. actually two books because it's hard to find. Any other questions about any of this stuff? Yeah, go ahead, Corey.
What would Psalm 22 have been written in? Because, I mean, the timing would have been either Old Hebrew or Aramaic. And when Jesus was on the cross, when he was saying that, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, he was, you know, quoting back to, like, Psalm 22, which describes his, you know, crucifixion and resurrection. So, I mean, if he was teaching it in Aramaic, I mean, would it have been already written in Aramaic, or was David probably writing it in Old Hebrew, or...
It was probably, most likely it was originally written in Hebrew, because we're looking back at it, you know, David's reign was somewhere around 1000 BCE, and so looking back at that time, there was some Aramaic intermix, but not so much, because really where Assyria comes to the fore is about 300 years later. So that's when we really start to see Aramaic starting to come into the mix in Judea. So most likely, originally, it was written in Hebrew. And most of the extant copies we have, as far as I know, are all in Hebrew. So that would have been a Hebrew rendition originally, but Jesus is quoting it in Aramaic. And it's preserved in Mark's Gospel in Aramaic. Yeah. But again, remember, Hebrew and Aramaic are very, very close. I mean, they're literally sister languages, almost like dialects of each other. I think I used this example in here before. One time I actually got to go to Scotland, which was kind of cool. And I remember my friend and I just stopping people on the street and asking for directions just so we could hear them talk. I mean, it was so cool to listen to these Scottish brogues, you know, and you couldn't hardly understand them at all. I mean, it was so difficult because it was so thick, you know, the way they're talking. Yet if I had asked them to write it down, it would have been much easier to understand, to read it, you know, because it's still English, you know. I've gone into parts of the South. Sometimes I can't understand you, Mr. Southern person. Yeah, exactly. And the spoken language with the dialect becomes very difficult to understand, but if you write it down, it's easier. Same thing here. You know, the language became very difficult to understand in terms of the difference between Aramaic and Hebrew, but written down, not so much, especially when you consider that they're only using consonants. And most of the changes took place in the vowel forms, not the consonant forms. And so it was a lot easier to be able to read back and forth, but harder to hear back and forth. And so so Jesus is making this translation. But to translate from Hebrew to Aramaic doesn't do violence to the thought forms, which is the most important thing, because the system is the same. That whole 22-letter and numerical system, all that stays in place. The worldview stays in place. The culture stays in place. And so a translation from that, it's not like there's a loss in translation. But now take it from Hebrew, Aramaic into Greek, and you're starting to see some significant loss in translation. And then take that into English, oh my gosh. You know, you can see what starts to happen. Even when we go from Spanish to English, there are just untranslatable idioms and thought forms. You just can't get across the sense from the language from one to the other. And this is what happens. But from Hebrew and Aramaic, you can almost interchange the parts. And so that's why that sort of academic discussion, did Jesus speak Hebrew or Aramaic, to me is kind of a distinction without a difference. You know. So. Anything else? You like that? Okay, well, I think we've beaten this horse as far as we're going to go. And unless anyone has some last-minute comments. next week we'll get into writing materials and the actual languages, and then we're going to get into versions of the Bible, which is also really interesting, especially when we get into the English versions and the genesis of it. We get to see William Tyndale burned at the stake. It's really cool stuff, you know. So, all right. Pastor Bill, would you like to close us in prayer, my friend?